This is the London FinTech Podcast, bringing you practical insights and approaches, stories and inspiration from the innovators who are building the new world of financial services. Welcome to London FinTech Podcast. This is an insurance innovation special. I'm at InsurTech Insights in London, and we're going to be talking about all things insurance and technology. I'm with the amazing James Benham.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And this is a London FinTech Podcast first, because we're actually recording in a caravan. Well,
yes.
That's a little unkind. It's a rather elegant Airstream that has been converted.
It's very nice.
Into a podcast studio. So definitely a first for me. And James, so look, we're fast friends, right? We met yesterday.
Yes.
And I've just been researching in the last 10 minutes before we got on air some of the things you've been doing. And you're a founder, you're an author, you're an insurance innovator, definitely an insurance geek.
You're also
a presenter and a podcast host.
Yes, yeah.
So I figured we were going to have this argument about whose podcast is this and who's asking the questions. So just to straighten up on that.
Your podcast, you're the host, I'm the guest. Always good to establish beforehand.
Yeah, which way is this going?
Exactly. You're in charge. You're the captain of the ship today.
That's okay. Right. So so what brings you to London this week, James?
Well, first, I love London. And if I had my druthers, I'd be here a couple of times a year minimum. Yeah. This is the center of the actual world for me, and it's the center of the insurance world for me. And so I really enjoy coming, so it's not hard to get me an excuse to come over here. Second, it's my 19-year-old daughter is at NYU. She's studying acting, and it's her spring break. And I said, she asked me to go to London, and I said, hey, guess what? It's InsurTech Week in London. Yeah. Let's go together. I can work, and we can go to West End shows every night. And so I went to Phantom of the Opera last night. I'm going to Matilda tonight, and I went to The Play That Goes Wrong two nights ago, and then I went to Into the Woods on Monday night. So I'm hitting a West End show every night. So a lot of things bring me to London, but of course the main reason on business, the main reason personally is my daughter, but the main reason on business is that InsurTech Insights is a phenomenal conference, 6,000 attendees, all geeking out to InsurTech, when you have a podcast called The InsurTech Geek, you kind of need to go where people are geeking out on InsurTech, and it seemed like a fantastic time. It has been. London continues to hold up to its promise of being one of the most interesting cities in the world. And of course, for insurance, it's kind of hard to be. This is the nexus. This is home for insurance.
Yeah, and we were talking about this briefly yesterday. So you're packing it in with the musicals and seeing the city. But we're only, as we're speaking this morning, we're only halfway through conference. So there's a lot more ahead. What I'd love to do this morning is really talk a bit about the conference and what we're seeing, what's going on in the sector. And then we'll also talk a bit about your businesses as well, because you've founded two businesses. You've been in this sector for over 20 years. So maybe we'll go there after we've talked a little bit about what's going on in the sector.
Founded a couple other ones that I sold. So these are the two that I'm still working on. And so it's been a fun 25-year career in technology and insurance.
And a few other things alongside. I always ask people on the show, what do they do when they're not working to decompress? And I think there's quite a long list for you there as well.
It is.
Because if I'm right, you're a commercial pilot and you're also a musician?
Yes, that is correct.
So what do you play?
So I played piano my whole life. Luckily, my mother and my sister were both piano players and singers. And my mother, especially. And I picked it up at an early age and was a competitive classical pianist, did all the Bach competitions and the Chopin and Mozart competitions, and did that until I was 18, thought I was going to be a professional classical pianist. Yeah. And then I found out how much money they made, and I was like, oh, I need to find a career that actually pays me some money. And my mom and my dad are both pilots, and my father's a air transport commercial pilot, but in rating only. He actually owned a Teflon company. And so I grew up flying in airplanes with them, and I continued the tradition. In fact, my mother's father was a pilot as well. So I love flying airplanes. I love playing piano. I love playing guitar. I picked up guitar during COVID, learned it on YouTube, and then started playing publicly at farmers markets. And it was just fun. You know, every piano player wants to be, well, most piano players want to be guitar players because you can bring your instrument with you. And so I just really think that life is about more than just work. And I work really hard. I work long days. You know, it's an average 10 to 12 hour day every day, and work on weekends sometimes. And, you know, my two daughters take high priority, but there's got to be a little bit thin sliver of 30 to 60 minutes a day where I get to do something creative. And that's what music is for.
Yeah. So for those who haven't picked up on this yet, and I've only known James since yesterday, he's a ball of energy. there's a lot going on and very creative. And I think you've been recording videos around London on your Meta glasses on the way here.
I did. Yeah. Well, today I intentionally took a black car so that I could get a different set of shots. Like I said, they're brilliant. I love the London, what do you call them? A cabbie?
The black cabs.
The black cabbies, right? Yeah. I love they have a glass roof now, and they're six seats in the glass roof, and it's a great view while you drive around town. So I really, really enjoy it a lot.
Yeah. We probably need to get the most of that experience for now before Waymo takes over and there are no black cabbies. So we're going to talk about AI in a minute.
I know. I was sitting there thinking about that this morning as I drove in the black cab. I was like, no, we can't lose. There's some things that we can't lose. This is one of them. There's nothing better than a London black cab. Yeah. Nothing. It's amazing.
And Waymo were at the conference yesterday doing a keynote talking about insurance risks for driverless cars. So there's a lot of AI at InsurTech Insights. There was last year. There is this year. So we're going to get into that. And perhaps, James, you've been walking the floor. You've got clients here. You've got tech partners here. So tell us a bit about your take on conference so far.
Yeah, this is a great event. Great. First off, let me just compliment the organizers of the event. InsurTech Insights does a phenomenal conference. They have one in New York in June. They have this right now in March, and they've got another one in Hong Kong that's later in the year in the late fall. And they know how to put an event on. These are huge events. It's really interesting what happened, because during COVID, everyone went hard on digital marketing automation tools to reach prospects. And then all of us went hard on it. And all of us started receiving excessive amounts of text message spam, email spam, phone call spam from automation platform, marketing automation platforms. So guess what happened? We all started ignoring all the emails, all the text, all the phone calls. And guess what became even more important to driving new business? Conferences.
Yeah.
And so the irony of the most isolating event in our lifetimes, which was COVID, was that we actually went deeper on in-person events. And so this is in the insurance space, despite all the automation, all the technology, all the innovation, this is how you meet people. This is it. Is you go to events, you go to after hours, you go to networking events, you spend time with people, you begin to trust them. And then you get to know people, and then you do business together. I mean, this is how it happens in insurance. I've been in insurance almost 25 years. This is how it's kind of always been. But it's actually funny because it's even more so because of the oversaturation of digital marketing tools.
Yeah.
Now it's actually pushed everybody even harder into conferences.
Yeah. And I'm not sure everyone saw that coming. So at the end of the pandemic, there were these firms spinning up with virtual conferences, and we were all going to be going to conferences in the metaverse with headsets.
Terrible idea. I tried it. It was awful.
And it's quite the opposite. And as you said it, I mean, the insurance industry, more than any, it's the human connection. Yeah. And I've talked about this in various interviews and with the team. And it's when we show up. It's when we get on a plane and we go somewhere and we shake some hands and we build some trust with our clients. That's what makes a difference.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And if you think about how insurance started in London, the Lloyd's Coffee Shop, right?
Yeah.
It's everybody knows the story. I mean, they would write risks on the board, and then an underwriter would write their name underneath the risk. And so it was a very person-to-person. Like, you knew that ship, you knew that captain, you knew that merchant that was shipping. Like, you got to know them, you got to trust them, and you would decide to risk capital on those. And it's always been this way. And, of course, the English, I hate to break it to you, did not invent insurance. The Babylonians kind of did 3,500 years ago. But, you know, modern insurance was really originated here. And it was always person to person. It still is. I mean, when you talk about even like a successful digital MGA, managing general agency, I know this is a fintech podcast, so not all the acronyms are going to port over to other areas of fintech. But
that one I know, but I think there might be a few more that you've got.
Exactly.
You're going to need to unpack. Yeah.
But like it's all about capacity. It's all, yeah. So if you want to start a digital managing general agency where you're coming at the market with a new thesis on how you're going to mitigate risk, right? Because that's really what it's all about, is about laying off risk. You've got to have capacity, and really the only people who are going to give you capacity are people who know you and trust you.
Yeah.
So it is still a very people heavy business in spite of all the digital. And insurance was an early innovator, so was banking.
Yeah.
These are two industries that are heavily regulated, and we're early innovators in technology, and they're suffering from that early innovator's dilemma. They have a lot of legacy systems and legacy baggage. Banking does, financial services, wealth management does. If you look at all the sectors of financial services, they were all actually fairly early adopters because they needed to scale their transaction capacity, and the only way to do it was with digital systems. So they're, you know, one of the industries still dealing with AS400s and COBOL and like really old legacy systems that need to be migrated. And so it's a very unique set of challenges that's fun to tackle.
Yeah, so you're clearly here to network.
Yeah,
we're podcasting. Are you presenting?
No, I am actually really enjoying not presenting.
Yeah.
I present it. You know, I've presented at around 500 conferences in the last 20 years.
Mm.
My busiest year, I did 53 keynotes in one year. It was one a week plus an extra one, and I have come to enjoy. Occasionally just attending a conference and being a fly on the wall. And that's what I'm doing this year.
We were laughing that when you were growing up, your mother was paying you to stop talking.
Yes. No. She tried to pay me to stop talking. Unsuccessfully.
So you might not be presenting, but you found the podcast caravan. So here we are.
I did.
Right. Yeah. So look, you can't walk us around the conference because we're in here and the conference is behind me.
Yeah.
But talk us around the conference. So what's out there?
You know, at any InsurTech Insights conference, you're going to have a breadth and depth of talks. Because even though insurance is one part of financial services, insurance itself is divided into some massive categories. Remember, this is a monster sub-industry, right? And so we have talks, of course, a lot of talks on AI. It's a very timely, relevant discussion, although I'm not sure there's many more ways we can skin that cat because it's a lot of – we've really beat up the topic of AI and disruption. I was talking about alternative capital markets. We went to a great talk. We had the senior minister or vice minister of finance from Lithuania, I think, yesterday. Yeah. I mean, it's really neat because you have some regulators national. Here in Europe, you have national regulators. In the United States, we have state regulators. And so definitely some really good discussions from state regulators on different laws that are changing. Access to capital is a really big conversation here because that's important for capacity. Just like it is in banking, right? You need access to capital so you can lend money. You need access to capital here so you can lay off risk. So there's conversations around that. There's conversations around technology. There's conversations around people, process, and technology. Organizational change management's always a really big conversation because, you know, financial services organizations functionally are entirely made up of people, right? I mean, it's not a set of industries where you have a large manufacturing facility. You know, the people make the product, and the product is a contract. In banking, the product's a contract. It's a loan, and insurance, it's a contract. It's a policy. So we have a lot of conversations around that, a lot of legal conversations. And then we have a great trade show, which I always enjoy because it's fun to see what technologies are coming onto the market. The trade show is almost entirely technology companies, if not all. I mean, I'm not sure there's a non-technology vendor here. Mm-hmm. And so it's a wonderful place to get to know the other technology companies. The tech sector, it's something really else that's interesting is that how market-specific the technology sector is. Like if you go to a banking conference, there are none of the same vendors.
Mm.
I mean, maybe just Microsoft. Like Microsoft will be at both maybe. Although I don't even think Microsoft is exhibiting here. So, I mean, you might get the core cloud platforms. Other than that, all the technology vendors are different. Mm. And, you know, so you have a very specific, you know, multi-billion dollar cottage industry of technology vendors that are here.
Yeah.
So you do that, and then there's wonderful networking. Obviously, they have some great media and podcasting sections of the conference, and And then, you know, of course, a boatload of networking events after hours.
Yeah, and some fabulous coffee. And I noted that one of the exhibitors here is running a coffee lounge. They were serving coffee until 3 p.m. And at 3 p.m. the espresso martinis started.
Yes.
And only in the insurance industry. And there was someone
caffeine
with
all day.
There was someone with a glass of wine before lunch yesterday. So
I don't do caffeine, and so I don't do coffee.
You're missing out.
Yeah, I can't stand coffee. I've tried it a million times and hate it. So
James, you touched on it with the 6,000 attendees, and just to put a bit more color on that, I think there's five stages. There's probably a couple of hundred exhibitors.
Oh, yeah.
Last year at this event, I counted 31 keynotes, and 26 of them had AI in the title.
Yeah.
This year, not quite so much, I think, but it's up there. It's still the primary theme. But what's coming through very loud and clear is that it's the human element, and it's the change management and the transformation that is the unlock to the AI advantage, and all the technology vendors that you were talking about, James, and all the products that are being offered. It's actually the human transformation element that is the fundamental. And we were hearing that last year, we were hearing it really loudly yesterday, listening to some of the presentations.
Sure, absolutely. Look, I've been implementing technology, both bespoke and off-the-shelf technology, for 25 years.
Yeah,
and it doesn't matter how good your tech is if you can't win hearts and minds of people to use it. It's useless.
Yeah,
you know, and one of the biggest problems in the technology industry is underutilization of technology product. That's a massive issue. You know, most companies dramatically underutilize the technology they have licensed, and that's a problem for the vendor. It's a problem for the client. And they don't spend enough time thinking about how they're going to get things adopted. And if ops doesn't walk alongside you, you could have the most brilliant invention in the history of humanity, and it's not going to get used.
Yeah. And you also touched on the sector specialism around insurance and how they take vendors that are different to the banking sector. There's always an exception to the rule, so I'm going to call out one who's a friend of the consulting company. So Quantexa, decision intelligence, leading in the decision intelligence space. They actually are exhibiting here, and I was chatting to CEO briefly yesterday on one of the panels, and they're very big in banking as well. So there's always an exception to the rule.
Sure,
you can connect data, you can find risk.
There are some payments providers that are common as well. Yeah.
But generally, I think you're spot on. The sort of commonality is generally going to be the platform plays and the cloud data platforms, and the actual sector applications on top are pretty distinct for the market.
I mean, insurance is a massive industry, and banking is a massive industry, and then wealth management's a massive. These are large businesses. You can lump them together into financial services, but I mean, because there's some overlap, obviously, between banking and insurance. Yeah. But man, they need specialized technology.
Before we jump right into today's episode, a quick thank you to our sponsor, NextWave. NextWave is an award-winning consultancy that is helping many of the world's leading banks, investment managers, and insurers deliver on their growth, efficiency, risk, and control goals and transform their businesses. With a senior team who have come from MD-level positions in major firms like HSBC, Barclays, and UBS, NextWave has both the deep industry expertise and the hands-on capabilities in AI, data, and automation to drive real results. More business outcomes and less PowerPoint from the consulting experience, as their clients like to say. NextWave has moved 2-week manual processes to 5-minute agentic automations, rescued global banking regulatory control programs, and digitized deal platforms, sustainability, and regulatory reporting systems. And they do much of this with hands-on engineering capabilities on leading technologies, which include ServiceNow, Alteryx, Quantexa, and Komunda. So if a modern and specialist alternative to the big brand consulting model sounds appealing, one which covers the full life cycle of strategy specialists and solutions, but with small practitioner teams, rapid delivery, and a better price point, then perhaps you should talk to NextWave. Visit nxwave.com to find out more and get in touch. That's nxwave.com. All right, let's get back to the episode.
So, James, so you talked about the insurance industry formation. Well, I didn't know it went quite as far back as you said, but the coffee shop bit and, you know, the Lloyd's names and everything being on bits of paper. And the industry has evolved since. And my observation is that there's quite some gap between those who are leading and those who are yet to sort of get on the whole automation and AI bandwagon. What's your observation on state of the sector. Where's insurance at the moment? Are we still shuffling PDFs and bits of paper?
Sure.
Or are we, AI chatbot assistants, AI agent operated InsurCos? Where's the sector at?
Yes. Both. In fact, you have both inside of the same company. I know quite a few large insurers that have sectors of their business that are wildly innovative and advanced, and then other sectors that are still running their policy administration, underwriting, and some claims off of Microsoft Excel spreadsheets. I think personally that Microsoft Excel is the cancer of business, and I intend to cut it out one tumor at a time. But it's really frustrating to see how prevalent Excel is in mission critical enterprise apps. Now, you should use Excel for ad hoc reporting, but what's the phrase you use here in England? Bits and bobs. There's bits and bobs of paper, but it's mainly Excel spreadsheets is the way that people are doing things, and that it's still very, 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 very prevalent. And so you can have inside the same company a section of the company that's undergoing an AI pilot program where they're dramatically streamlining and automating underwriting, and then you'll go to their claims division and you'll see Excel spreadsheets everywhere and Word docs and PDFs. And I mean, it's kind of hilarious because you've got a little bit of everything, which is why some general purpose large language models are nice, because they can deal with all that unstructured data and make some sense of it usually. And so it's really quite interesting. But the state of the industry is that it was an early adopter. It's got an early adopter's dilemma that it has some very old systems that are very difficult to migrate off of. Some of the world's largest insurers take 32 systems to generate a quote. 32 connected systems to generate a quote because they have so many old legacy mainframe applications that don't talk to each other. The formulas and the algorithms that drive the industry are embedded in those pieces of software, and extracting them has proven to date too expensive to extract, and so they've had to maintain these old systems. And so you've got this kind of a what we would say is a hodgepodge of solutions that are cobbled together to deliver the solution. The solution being, underwriting, claims handling, loss control, kind of like the big fundamental tenets of insurance. And so, there's a lot of opportunity still for technology companies to help insurers automate. That I would argue that about a third of the employee base in insurance is clerical in nature. Clerical in nature, meaning they sit at a computer and key data in or key data out, or they run reports, or they log into websites. And there's a big opportunity to take those people and retrain the ones that want to be retrained into higher functioning licensed roles now, because we have a, like a lot of industries, a shortage of quality talent at the higher end experienced licensed ranks. And we need people. And so it's that's where AI, I don't view AI as a workforce reducer, at least in the next 2 to 3 years. Hard to see where it's going to go beyond that, but I definitely view it as something that allows us to finally meet some of our labor needs by automating these really, really clerical. Because even some of your most senior, experienced underwriters and claims adjusters, which are some of that's kind of like the workforce of the like the workhorses of the insurance industry is underwriters and adjusters. Your most senior ones have to waste 30% to 50% of their time on manual data entry and keying things in. And if we can automate those tasks, they can do higher functioning things. And, they choose to not quote a lot of business just because they don't have the time. And so we've got a big opportunity to fix some long-standing problems. The other big problem in insurance is backlog of things they want out of technology, their technology groups that they can't get, we can actually get to now.
That really resonates, and it's in many ways it's not dissimilar to wider financial services. With the Next Wave team, my consulting business, we work across banking and insurance, and one of our banking clients a while back was running 800 different applications in their markets division. Now, that wasn't just to make a quote, it was to do a lot of things, but that complex spaghetti infrastructure of legacy and modern technologies is common, and the spreadsheet problem as well. That same client had 30,000 spreadsheets that ran the month end close, and we're working on spreadsheet elimination at a number of clients.
But you have to do it. Yeah. It's hard. It's actually really, even with the best AI tools, and we're using the best AI tools on the planet right now. Okay, we've got Cursor agents running. We've got Claude Cowork and Claude Code, and we've got. I can run through all the tools that we're using right now, and we are having to go through spreadsheet by spreadsheet by spreadsheet, Power BI report by Power BI report by Power BI report. We call it wood chipping. I don't know if you use that same phrase here in England.
Love that, but
we have to wood chip through each one of these. It is that you can't just take the folder of 10,000 spreadsheets and feed it into Copilot. You can do that, by the way. You can say, Copilot, analyze 10,000 spreadsheets, and it'll do it.
Yeah.
Not great. Not a great job. It doesn't have a context window big. It doesn't even have a context window large enough to deal with that much data. And so you'd still have to have people. And then the really complex part is you can't do these automation projects. I've tried to do these automation projects without interviewing people. Mm. I tried just watching what they do on the computer, looking at their files and spreadsheets, and then you have to interview them. You gotta talk. Yeah. You gotta talk to people. I mean, your average data clerk at a bank or an insurance institution has 20 to 35 manual tasks they're performing every day, and you've got to understand every single one of them, and then you've got to build automations for them. And then you've got to say, okay, all right, now that we do this, what's that person's backlog? What are the higher functioning things we can put them on? Like, where do we really need them? You know, like in banking, it's loan processing is a really big, you know, contract review and loan processing or reviewing loan docs. Yeah. You know, so it's like, you know, okay, maybe we can put them over on production so we can write more loans. And insurance, maybe we can put them on underwriting so we don't have to no-quote people.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you got to think about that. And you have to go through a person at a time.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
And there was a lot there. And we were geeking out on this briefly yesterday on some of the AI co-work and coding assistant tools that you and your team are using. And what I would add is that once you've figured out how to refactor a spreadsheet, then you've got to figure out, well, where are you going to put that data flow and that workflow?
Yes.
So, and this is a regulated industry. So black box AI that's probabilistic is not the right answer in many cases. So you need guide rails, you need visible data pipelines, you need to be able to measure and audit. So perhaps just coming back to what you're practically doing with clients, just give us a couple of examples of sort of tools and techniques that you're doing to move the needle, getting folks off of these unversioned, uncontrolled end-user compute spreadsheets onto something that's a proper system. And
at the end of the day, we want them in a structured data system, right?
Yeah.
Like we do. Even though we have the ability now to read any level of unstructured data, we're in regulated industries.
Yeah.
Regulated industries. That means that we've got to have certainty, absolute certainty, certainty that a large language model cannot necessarily deliver us, that not a single transaction is going to be lost.
Yep.
And that we can go and audit all the transactions and understand how the query works, where the data is, if it processed successfully, and have it have an audit log that supports every transaction and every change, right?
Yeah.
Banking requires that, and insurance requires that. Wealth management requires that. Investing requires that. You've got to have detailed audit. And so at the end of the day, we want all of these folks, because a lot of these transactions can sometimes exist in Excel spreadsheets. And so we've got to, but let me start with this. Let me back up. We have to always start with the first, most important question is, why are we automating this?
Yeah.
Like we have to look at what they're doing and say, do we still need to do this? And I've got a great example. I've got a regulatory reporting requirement at all my clients. All insurance policies have to be reported. The vast majority. There's a lot of regulatory forms. I'm speaking about the United States in particular.
Yeah.
You have to file regulatory forms depending on the state, sometimes 3, 4, 10 per claim, and sometimes 1, 2, 3. Probably you've got to file a lot of forms. The generation of those forms often is quite manual.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also have to send a lot of letters to claimants or letters to policyholders. Mm-hmm. And then some states will have a policy change where they used to require that you print and mail it and postmark it, and now they allow you to send it digitally. So the first question you have to ask with every single task you encounter, because this is a task-by-task automation. That's what this is. It's a big pile of wood. The wood is made up of tasks. There's tens of thousands of them because you've got 20 or 35 per person, and you might have 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 people. So you've got hundreds of thousands of tasks. You've got to look at all of them, and one by one, you have to identify, do we still have to do this?
Yeah.
Do I still have to print and mail this form, or can I transmit it electronically now? Because that's going to impact how I solve this problem. And then, of course, the most important one, do I still even have to generate this form?
Yeah.
Does the client require it? Does the state require it? Does the federal government require it? That's the kind of the best example I can give you is you have to ask. So that's why, like, when you say people, process, technology, I say the same thing. You have to say it in one sentence, people, process, technology, because it goes hand in hand. Like, okay, first off, do we still need to do these processes? Secondly, if we do, how do we apply technology to make them better? Because if you actually make a flawed process more efficient, you just suck faster.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. I mean, you're just gonna achieve an undesired outcome at a faster rate. Yeah. You could literally make the organization lose money more quickly, which is wild that you could accelerate losses with technology, but you actually can.
Yeah.
And so first question is, why are we doing this? Second question is, does it still have to be done this way? And the third question is, okay, now that we understand the parameters around this, how do we automate it? And then, okay, this is a regulatory form we have to file when we get a first notice of loss on a claim. Who do we have to send it to? How? What are all of our options? And okay, now let's automate it. Let's take it out of their hands. Okay, now what are we going to do with the person? Okay, are we going to train them up to this? Are we going to train them up to that? Is, you know, what's going to happen with the people? And now that it's a new process, we have to retrain people, right? Because the people above them can't have to be able to monitor what's going on in the systems. Where do they find the audit log? Where do they initiate the action? And so there's got to be a pretty detailed training plan that goes along with everything. So that's kind of how I view it.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned tasks. There's at least one vendor in the conference hall who have a task mining offering. And I'd not heard that phrase until yesterday. We all heard of process mining, but they said, no, it's got to get down to the task level.
You have to get down to the task level.
Yeah.
Because every single person in the organization has dozens of them.
Yeah. And you touched on a few tools. So you talked about Claude Code, you talked about Vercel. Anything else in the toolbox?
Yeah, Cursor. Cursor's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cursor is in... It's a VDI. So we develop code with Cursor. So it's basically like a VS Code variant where you can Visual Studio. I'm sorry, I'm using a lot of phrases that don't make any sense. Cursor is a tool that you
use. I think most of the audience would have heard some of these things.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Cursor is a tool that you use to develop code. So I started writing software in 1991. And I would use command line interfaces, which we call CLIs. Mm. But you can also use an IDE. And it's basically a development environment where you can, you know, review your code and then compile it and then do things with it. Cursor automates that in a really big way. And it ties into your preferred large language model of choice or multiple, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
Where you can have like a suite of experts, right? And we... particularly right now, and this opinion's going to change in 3 weeks, I'm sure, like Opus 4.6 from Claude. It's really a wonderful for writing code. The first thing that AI large language model creators specifically did is they taught code how to write code so that they could use their own product to write their own product, which is why you see the pace of innovation. Like, we talked to the folks at Cursor, and I think they said that 70 or 80% of their code is written by their own product. So Cursor is making Cursor.
Yeah.
Claude is making Claude.
They did that with about 10 developers and Claude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Claude, that whole release.
Yeah, because Claude's making Claude.
Yeah.
And that's why you're seeing so much rapid innovation is that Claude's iterating itself.
Yeah.
There are some scary use cases around that that come up where they try to deactivate old versions and the old versions say they don't want to be deactivated. And you have some things going on that... are quite interesting. We've got to put some guardrails on how this they are putting, in particular, and that's why I like Claude probably the most, is they're, in my opinion, putting the best guardrails on AI of any of the providers out there. But
yeah,
Claude Code is really wonderful. It's not the same type of tool as Cursor, and obviously you can only use their LLMs. And you know, for personal use, if I'm doing personal research, because I like to just research topics. Gemini is my favorite. It's deep research mode is phenomenal. I think Google, and then for generating videos, generating photos, if you're an entrepreneur like us and you want to be able to generate your own designs, graphics, logos, videos, audio, Gemini is incredible. Now, that being said, I'm going to say this. My daughters hate AI, and they're 19 and 16.
Interesting.
And so I showed them an AI-generated video, and they're like, Dad, you can't use that.
Yeah.
Like, that you can't use that. And I was walking in the New York subway last week with my 19-year-old, and she pointed at the ad. She goes, that ad. I said, what? What's wrong with it? She goes, it's AI-generated. Everyone hates it. Everybody's been taking markers and then, like, writing on top of the AI-generated ads because they don't lie. I'm like, whoa. That's...
Yeah.
So there's some very interesting backlash, human backlash to AI stepping into the creative arts.
Yeah.
But I like using Gemini and Claude. I really don't use ChatGPT anymore.
Yeah.
And then from development, Claude Code, Claude Cowork, which has changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not using Claude Cowork, it's truly incredible. And then, obviously open, you can't have a conversation around AI without talking about OpenClaw. Just don't install OpenClaw on your work computer.
No.
You know, get a nice bare metal machine and then put it there, or do a virtual server in the cloud. But, you know, that's really the heart. You know, OpenClaw is agentic AI. OpenClaw got acquired.
Yeah.
It was one employee, got acquired for a boatload of money.
Yeah.
You have these really interesting things going on in the space.
Yeah.
And we're in the baby phase of this, and it's already getting super interesting.
Yeah, I think we're all trying to navigate that world. And you touched on a bunch of tools, and some of them more frontier than others. For our part... Our team has just created an agentic ethanol solution. It's using two agents and a fraud model. The fraud model's in Alteryx visual data platform. The agentic bit is in Google. It's on Gemini Mini 3, I think.
Yeah.
And it's only by playing with these tools that you work out what works and what doesn't. The first time we built it, it had six agents and it cost £2 to run. And then there was too much drift and inconsistency in the output. So we had to refactor it to two agents and change the model. And now it costs 10 pence to run. And you were talking about this yesterday, the cost of tokens, that's now a thing in the way that you price. And your consulting services and your development services, that's a very real thing. The cost of the compute now.
It is. And you wonder how much of the technology industry are just going to be token resellers. You know, like you look at some of the pure AI companies, and they're really just a layer sitting on top of a large model and a large language model, and they're reselling tokens, and like Cursor resells tokens. That's really how they make money, is they resell the tokens underneath them. And so I don't know what it's all going to look like. I know that we're definitely in hype cycle right now. Yeah. You know that.
Yeah.
We're definitely in hype cycle, and we're going to hit some valleys.
It's at the peak of overinflated expectations something like that, I think
absolutely.
They call it.
Yeah, I really kind of believe we're at peak.
You think we're about to dive into the trough of disillusionment?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah,
because the brutal reality is that change is hard.
Well, this is what we were talking about, the long tail, the enormous runway of whole swathes of firms that are still running. You know, I used to joke that the most digital thing in compliance was a PDF, for many functions and units in across the whole sector, that is still the case, right? And that's not going to change overnight.
It is, and we're going to have some big stumbling blocks that we trip over. You know, like you're going to have models make some big mistakes that are going to cost some firms a lot of money, and then they're going to tap the brakes on things. And look at, like, let's just look at something completely unrelated but kind of related, and that's self-driving cars.
Yeah.
The CEO of General Motors, one of the largest companies historically in the United States, she said that by 2018 all of their fleet would be self-driving.
Yeah.
And we're in 2026, and let me tell you, I had an Escalade with GM Super Cruise, and it sucked.
Yeah.
And it was a 2022. And it's now 2026, and I drove a GM with Super Cruise recently, and it sucked.
Yeah.
And so I bought a Tesla Model Y, which is phenomenal and incredible. But it's just become phenomenal and incredible with the last few software releases. And so the tail on that, the initial hype by Peter Diamandis, who is one of the self-reported visionaries of the world and predictors of the future. He's good buddies with Ray Kurzweil, who's a major futurist.
Yeah.
These guys were predicting that by 2016 to 2018, and then maybe at the worst by 2020, we wouldn't be driving cars anymore. And look, I just drove here in London. I mean, 95% of the cars had people with their hands on the steering wheel.
Yeah.
98% maybe. I'm one of the weirdos who does not touch my steering wheel because I trust my Model Y, and I let it be in full self-driving. So I think that's a really good example of how you can have like peak expectation, and then you get down to the trough of disillusionment, and now we're coming out on self-driving into some real technologies that work. And I think we're going to kind of be in the same thing here where we realize that it's a lot harder and a lot more difficult and there's more stumbling blocks than we anticipated. And, you know, at the end of the day, it is going to be radical. I mean, this is going to be – this is the third – I would argue the third major industrial revolution is the AI revolution.
Yeah, 100%.
And it may be humanity's last invention.
Yeah.
You know, like if you think about it. Because we're using AI to invent a lot of things now. And so this may be humanity's last great invention. Yeah. But I hope not.
But for the meantime, there's going to be lots of work for the 6,000 people out there and for the consultancies of the world.
Oh, there's, And again, insurance is still going to be, we're still going to have insurance companies because you still got to lay risk off. We're still going to have banks because you still need credit and lending. It's just, you know, what part of those? They're talking about this being a, you know, major disruptor to white collar jobs. I don't know. I don't know if that's the case because what I'm seeing is the second we automate tasks, you know what happens? Other tasks are filling in their queue. And so I'm not sure that that's actually going to be the case. I don't know. But I know that the first industrial revolution here in England, the Luddites, who were the textile workers, I know that their jobs changed, but I know that unemployment actually went down over a 9-year period in England when they automated the textile mills, right?
Yeah.
That the jobs moved, or had to retrain. And so that retraining is going to take some time. So I think it's an exciting time. I think that there's a lot of work to do to improve industry. And I think there's a lot of work that people have done for the last 75 years of computerized desk work that's really boring and menial, and people are eager to get out of doing that work.
Yeah. We're going to have to see. I mean, there's two schools of thought. Obviously, that there's everyone's going to be out of a job, and that's a sort of an existential risk. And together with that, of course, the risk that the AI kind of goes rogue. But then there's another school of thought that if you can amplify human productivity and do more, then we're going to do more and upskill, you know, with AI co-workers, and there's going to be more work for everyone and more
more
benefits for humanity as a result.
We're in the technology industry, right? You and I.
Yeah.
There's tens of millions of people. There's a million developers in Bangalore, India. A million software developers in Bangalore, India. That job didn't exist 50 years ago.
No.
So, like, you have hundreds of millions of jobs that were created by technology and automation.
Yeah.
When you had the Industrial Revolution, the very first one, you had hundreds of millions of jobs created. What actually happened over the last 200 years is that average work hours per week dropped by 50%. Okay.
Yeah.
We had the ability, because GDP per capita went up, we had the ability to have with a labor movement, by the way. You can't factor out the labor movement. We had the ability to move to a 5-day work week instead of a 6 or 7-day work week. We had the ability to eliminate child labor. We had the ability to radically improve medical technologies and extend the human life. You had all these things happening. But I want to remind everybody, when they think about everybody being unemployed, that we have massive labor shortages all over the place because we have a declining population in the Western society. England, United States, we're at birth rates below 2.2. 2.2 is replacement rate. We're at 1.74. Right now we had 24 universities closed in the United States last year because we don't have enough students. So like we have some existential threats that are actually bigger. And it was interesting, the guy who wrote the book Population Bomb passed away yesterday, I think. It was yesterday. I read an article about his passing, and he predicted that the world would be overpopulated and we would have no resources and no productivity. This was decades ago, and it was used as a fear-mongering tactic to scare everybody that the world was going to be wildly overpopulated, wouldn't have any resources. And the reality is wildly different than he predicted. He was completely wrong. We actually now, China is, because he was arguing for one child per family policies. Well, China reversed theirs because they're running out of people to do things.
Yeah.
And they're automating with AI at a rapid pace.
Yeah.
And they are desperate to have more citizens because their population is going to be cut in half in the next 30 to 50 years.
Yeah.
And they completely reversed their one child per family policy. So you've got to consider that, like, when you're listening to the fearmongers saying that, oh, there's not going to be work for anybody. I said, well, we have a population problem. Everywhere. Russia's paying people to have children. China's encouraging people to have more children. The United States is doing the same thing because we actually need more workers in the workforce.
Yeah.
And so that's something that we have to think about. I know it's a little heady for the topic of fintech and insurtech, but it will impact our industry, insurance, banking. They'll all be impacted.
So yeah, we have strayed sort of a bit into the futurism topic,
yeah.
but in a great way. So taking all of that, so taking the innovation and what's going on in the sector and the legacy structures that firms have and the future dynamic, you know, what do you think should be top of agenda for insurance CEOs?
Well,
right now,
you know, building sustainable companies has to be the most important thing. Financially sustainable companies, right? Like, one of the biggest challenges we've had in the United States has been naggingly persistent bad loss ratios.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, that's more than anything. If you don't have stability, you have nothing in insurance.
Yeah.
Insurance is about laying off risk, right?
Yeah.
And if you don't have stable carriers, if you don't have stable markets, you don't have an industry. I'm going to provide one like great example, the Florida property market. Florida is a massive property market, huge.
Yeah.
Florida is a huge state, right? A lot, tens of millions of people, big state, a lot of coastal exposure, a lot of hurricane exposure. And they had a massive problem in the last 10 years with capacity, because they had some hurricane problems, but they, more important than that, they had legal issues with the way their laws were structured. And so I think as an insurance industry, we have to make sure that our markets are profitable, that they have combined ratios under 100,
yeah,
you know, so they're not losing money, and that we're pricing our product correctly, and that we're factoring in all of our risks. In that case, it's easy to say Florida was an environmental risk. The real problem was lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
The real problem was a group of plaintiffs' attorneys that used venture capital and private equity money to harvest lawsuits. Then they did assignment of benefit claims with roofing companies, where they colluded with roofing companies to go and do full roof replacement if a single tile was broken. And of course, the attorney took half of the proceeds, right? And so the state of Florida had to go in and prohibit assignment of benefit on property claims. They had to prohibit all the tactics their lawyers were doing, which was very challenging because the Speaker of House of Florida was a trial lawyer,
okay,
plaintiff's attorney. And so the governor had to override the Speaker of the House. They had to go in, they had to make a lot of law changes so they would literally have any carriers left in the state of Florida. And so I think as technologists, we can do a lot to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse, and to have run efficient markets to make sure that the insurance industry doesn't go belly up in key markets. Like, we have to have property insurance. Like, if you don't, you can't have property. And so I think that's actually what we need to be thinking about more than anything, is how,
yeah,
do we make sure that insurance companies stay profitable, stay alive? And as insurtechs, how do we make sure that insurtechs, once they IPO and go public, and we've had a few very prominent insurtech IPOs where their combined ratios were consistently and persistently over 100.
Mm.
And their stock, and I've got, you know, Lemonade and Hippo on my mind right now, their stock prices dropped 95% post-IPO because they couldn't move to profitability. Now, Lemonade's recovered, Hippo didn't. You know, you had some that have started to figure it out, but they've got to be profitable. Like,
yeah,
at the end of the day, it's like gravity.
Yeah.
You know, insurtechs, like a digital MGA, they've got to make money. The insurtech carriers, the insurtech MGAs. And so that, I think that actually needs to be our number,
yeah,
one priority, is how do we make sure this industry stays profitable so the market would stay liquid and we have enough capacity.
Yeah. So really bringing it back to business fundamentals,
yeah,
there, which I really like. And, you know, we've talked a lot about insurtech. We've talked about the sector. We've talked about the future. We've talked about the Florida property situation, which I didn't know about. So that's an,
yeah,
amazing story. I don't know how much time we've got left, but I'd love to talk a little bit about JBK and Terror. So in amongst, you know, being a pilot, a musician, a keynote speaker, a podcaster, and an insurtech geek, you're a founder of, I think, and you said there were several, but two current firms, one of which is a consultancy, another one is a SaaS company. So you're actually exposed on all fronts, because you've got a consultancy, you've got a SaaS company. We're talking about the SaaS apocalypse
two separate businesses.
Yeah.
So I have two separate companies, JBK and Terra. JBK is a consultancy. I started it in my dorm room at what you would call uni.
Yep.
Texas A&M, the world's finest institute of higher education. Americans are very focused on college affiliations. And so I've been doing that 25 years. I've got a great team of about 280 people that help and work with me and work side by side with me, innovating at insurance companies, going in and building bespoke solutions, taking over old legacy maintenance, taking over ETL, extract, transform, and load, the movement of data around the industry and organizations, building bespoke custom applications, and then, of course, doing AI implementations. So that's the JBK. We operate in the United States. I mean, really, I would say the Americas, but the functional reality is that our clients, even though they're global insurers, we operate in the United States. And then we have offices outside of the United States. You know, I have a heavy presence in Argentina and South Africa and the United States, but our clients are in the U.S. And then, you know, Terra is another. And I've had a SaaS product, SaaS company before. I was really heavy in the construction sector, and I got into it really through risk management and insurance. But I ended up building with my team. I say I. It's we. It's always we.
It's always a team sport.
It's a team sport. We built a platform called SmartBid. We got around 250,000 companies to use it. So it was really, it really went bananas. We had about, I'd say, 1,200 enterprise customers. And then we had about 250,000 Aussies would call them subbies, subcontractors, that would log in and bid on systems. On construction projects, and then we'd do pre-qualification. It was tied to sub-default insurance. So I had that run. We did 12 years. I sold that company in 2018, sold Smart Insight in 2018. In 2020, I said, you know, I want to have another SaaS company, and I want to fill a void that I see in the insurance space, and that is a really, really, really good core suite of policy and claim software that's going to work for small insurers. Because, you know, Texas alone, my state, which, by the way, if it was a country, would be the eighth largest economy on the planet, has a $3 trillion GDP just in Texas. We have 800 insurers there. Wow. 800. And all over the United States, there's self-insured groups, self-insured funds, monoline carriers, and like small, we're talking about small companies in the big scheme of things, but they're good size organizations, and they really can't afford a lot of the core systems on the market. And there's too high of a failure rate of implementation of those systems. They don't have CIOs, so they really don't have a sophisticated technology organization internally. And so we built Terra to try and disrupt the core system market at the low end. I'm not competing against the big guys at all.
I'm not competing.
I'm down in the meat and potatoes of the insurance business. Captives, SIGs, SIVs, smaller TPAs, amazing people, amazing organizations, critical to functionality of the insurance industry. And we built a core system, and we did it radically different on tech. It's cloud native, AI native, but we also, because we give away all the AI features, but we also, it is radically different on contract. We have no contracts. We just have a license. Our clients can leave at any time. They pay no money up front, $0 in implementation fees, and they don't pay for their licensing until they're live and happy.
Wow.
And so we guarantee.
And how's it going?
It's amazing. Yeah. It's like we signed up a new customer yesterday, a pretty good size one. And, you know, and good size for us.
Yeah,
the you know, the scraps from the table of the big guys are our meals, right?
It's funny with the consulting business. I've never never referred to it as the scraps, but we're trying to position as the smart alternative to the big brand consultancies. And if you want smaller agile teams that are going to move the needle for the business, better price point, better technology, and practitioners, then that's where you come.
And arguably the same or better people. I mean, if you think about it, like, you and I both worked at much larger competing consultancies.
Yes.
You were at Anderson. I was at PricewaterhouseCoopers 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was an intern there when I was 21 years old, I was billing out at $250 an hour in 2001 as an intern.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, my gosh. You know, and so I went and started my own business. And you know, obviously the rate wasn't that in 2001. And they got the same guy.
Yep.
And so... you know, and this scraps is not meant as a derogatory term. I'm just saying that, like, you know, you, the crumbs, it's the crumbs, right? It's the projects that, but the reality is that you and I both work for some of the largest firms in the world and we do a lot of wonderful value add work.
And this is a story that I've been sort of amplifying on socials, particularly on LinkedIn, that it's okay for world-class, you know, Fortune 500 enterprise to hire specialist consultancies with small focused teams to move the needle. And perhaps it wasn't so much okay 3-5 years ago because you needed a bit of brand permission and board recognition. But actually, when you're focusing on value and specialism, you can find that in the boutiques and in the focused firms. So I think the pendulum has swung a bit, and to the benefit of businesses like yours.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I had a very large global insurer 10 years ago that said, "Oh, you know, we can't work with vendors who are under 5,000 employees or something." I'm like, why? I mean, I've got 300. Like, what's the issue? And they came back around last year and they said, you know, we're changing our opinion on this.
Yeah.
And we're actually going to fragment our supply chain a little bit, bring some specialty providers in. I'm like, about time. Like,
we're seeing it. We were onboarded by one of the large UK banks last year, and the RFP process was 9 months, and it was a conscious move to dilute the consulting pool with some innovation and specialist challenger firms.
Yeah.
And the RFP actually had a section on it, which was a diversity section of various boxes to tick. One of them was size diverse, and you had to be under 250 employees.
Yeah.
And so because a Next Wave team is well under that threshold currently. And so we ticked the box, and it was almost part of the bank's diversity of supplier base policy to bring on firms like us. And we've got another one we're filling out today for one of the larger wealth managers, and the same questions there, and the same intent is there, and it's to swing away, to offer alternatives to the business. There's the right time and the right place to use big brand, big consultancies, but it's not always the right answer.
So, I agree completely.
So look, we've talked about a lot of things, and I think we are going to time out. But just sort of bringing this home, you've had a long and very interesting career, and we've touched on all sorts of milestones in that journey. But if you could sort of distill that experience, and is there one career learning that you wish you'd known at the start that you'd like to play forward, perhaps to the audience or the next generation? Here's James's top tip.
Yeah, it's. Focus is the most difficult thing to acquire.
Focus.
Yeah. I wish I had learned. I'm still working on this.
So you wish you'd perhaps not done quite so many different things?
On a personal level, those things, you know, look, I already work 10 to 12 hours a day. Okay. So, yeah. I mean, I'm putting my time in on work. My personal hobbies are about time, and I've tried to center them around things I can do with kids and travel and fun. But I'm talking about at work. I wish I had learned how to focus earlier. When I started the company, I worked for 12 different industries, and we did, you know, 12 different things. And if I had boiled the ocean down more, I would have been able to become an expert faster, and I would have been able to focus in faster and dial in. And you know, I miss going to my construction conferences. I miss, because I spoke at a lot of them. I really hung out. But it was exhausting keeping up with construction and insurance.
Yeah.
Even though they were quite interrelated, it was still exhausting. And I just wish I had learned how to focus earlier and how to say no. I'm still working on saying no, because there's a million opportunities, and The difference between success and failure in so many cases is the willingness of an entrepreneur to resist the temptation to chase shiny objects and to focus on doing less better. You know, do less better. And that's probably one of my best pieces of advice. And that, of course, and I'm a bootstrapped entrepreneur. I think you are too.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to continue to preach the message. I wrote a book on it called Be Your Own VC about bootstrapping. And that's an important principle.
That is such a great insight. And it, you know, it echoes for me as well. Quite early in my career, I did a psychometric test with one of the consultancies, and one of the dimensions was this thing called completer finisher, which was on a scale of 0 to 13 and how much you finish the tasks that you take on. And I scored 0 out of 13. And for the first time, I had this metric that said, you keep starting things and not finishing them. And so I worked on that, and now I'm much better at it. But it's the same point. And maybe it's an entrepreneur and a founder thing. I don't know.
It is often. A problem that is very, very, very challenging. A lot of us are ADHD and either diagnosed or undiagnosed, and we have to learn to focus. It's hard. It's very, it's difficult to say no.
Yeah.
Because there's opportunity when you're an entrepreneur. There's opportunities that come on your desk every day.
Yeah.
And so you have to fight the temptation to chase all of them.
And you're forever time slicing. If you were to ask the Next Wave team, they'd probably say, "Yeah, Tony's always doing two things at once." So look, you and me both. But just as we close this out, and again, it's always interesting to ask. I always ask people what they're reading, if they have any time to read. But sometimes it's, well, I'm not reading, I'm listening, because, you know, we're all listening to podcasts and other things. But anything that's on your playlist at the moment?
Well, I love the Acquired podcast.
Me too.
It's just so good. It's so incredibly good. And I'm peeling through old episodes of Acquired.
It's great for long journeys. And it's because anyone who hasn't listened, you know, Ben and David, they do four hours episodes.
It's an audiobook every episode. You know, the one that I loved recently was on Epic, which is
Epic Systems.
Yeah, Epic Systems.
That's the My Chart. That's the medical.
Yeah.
And I've listened to that.
It was so instructional. And so I learned.
They've got this crazy tech campus that they do. It's wild.
But but they're also wildly profitable, and they built a great technology company. And so I just think there's a lot of lessons to learn, be learned listening to all those. And then, you know, book wise, I've got 12 in my hopper and Audible. I do listen as well. And, you know, Good to Great, Great by Choice. Jim Collins is great. Gino Wickman is great. You know, I could run through the list. Of course, you know, there, again, lots and lots of great books. David and Goliath, Tipping Point. Malcolm Gladwell is a perennial favorite for me. Those are all books that make a difference. Yesterday I was talking about the book called Drive about employee compensation. So, you know, that I think it's important to hit some major business authors, but, you know, study case studies. Like Harvard Business School, their MBA is a case study driven MBA education. And I think that's what I love about Acquired is that it's business case studies.
Yeah, it's business history lessons and case studies. Yeah. And I mean, that's also, you know, peak podcast as well. So putting aside the lifestyle and the sort of modern wisdom type podcasts, which also are doing incredibly well and incredibly well produced, Acquired's really unique in what the product that they're producing. And they're now sponsored by JP Morgan and doing live shows for thousands of people.
They were in Radio City Music Hall with Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan. I was like, oh my gosh.
And the production on that show is incredible. They somehow managed to do 4 hours and they don't have a single filler word. They never say once. And
they don't.
The first time I did one of these 18 months ago, and we used a little bit of AI to pick up on it, I said I'm gonna 583 times.
It's a hard habit, right?
Get a little bit better, but there's a few in this conversation. Anyway, so if anyone wants to find out more about James, or get in touch,
My website is jamesbenham.com. It's a proper English name, Benham, B-E-N-H-A-M, jamesbenham.com. The company, JBK, is at jbknowledge.com. Terra is at terra.insure. And my podcast is the insuretechgeek.com.
InsureTechGeek.com. And you're on episode 174, so you're catching up with London FinTech Podcast. You know, we've got a 10-year back catalogue, so I didn't do it all, but we're slightly ahead. But check that out. If anyone out there who's into insurance and technology, then check James's podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much.